Good evening, everybody. It's a great pleasure to have you all here, and especially Tordis Arrhenius, in this within the frame of our project Wohnungsfrage. And tonight, it's just like the coming nights, it's an extension of our academy, like the public part of our academy, of the Wohnungsfrage project. Here at the Wohnungsfrage Academy, we, together with Reinhold Martin, actually gave a kind of subtitle to the Wohnungsfrage, to the housing question, and Reinhold turned it into the housing system. And it seems very timely and adequate to have Tordis here tonight talking about restoring the welfare state, quite a systemic approach to housing. And with a very particular situation in Sweden from the 1960s-70s, the 1 million program will be at the center of that presentation, probably one of the most interesting cases in terms of housing programs within the welfare state. Tordis is a professor of cultural heritage at the Department of Social Change and Culture at Linköping University in Sweden. Before, she has taught many years in Oslo at the architecture school, running a PhD program there, and being very, very much focused as now on contemporary critical issues in heritage and urbanism, somehow always within a historical perspective that informs contemporary actions and strategies. Her books include Place and Displacement, Exhibiting Architecture, which is published by Lars Müller Publishers and was presented at last year's Venice Biennale, and of course the book The Fragile Monument, which I think is really one of the most interesting books and relevant books about the very idea of a monument, and also the contradictions when we talk about monuments or buildings from the past and their contemporary reconstructions and constructions. Something that was actually partly presented also at last year's Berlin Documentary Forum here at the HKW. So it's a great pleasure to have you here again in Berlin. Please give a warm welcome to Tordis.
Yes, thank you for that introduction. And I also want to start thanking in some way the whole theme behind Wohnungsfrage. I've been so impressed by these 3 days. It's been absolutely amazing, and I learned a lot. Restoring the welfare state. This is a research project, as Niklas pointed out, who is based at the Linköping University, the Department of Culture Studies. And it's a collaboration between the different architecture schools. And as Niklas was saying, I have a background in architecture. And there, under the heading of architecture and welfare, we're trying to look into actually the specifically this kind of fraught relationship between architecture and welfare from a lot of different perspectives. I will present this research project that is really in its kind of beginning, and I will try to point out certain aspects that I think we need to kind of look further into. Large-scale planning, urbanization, and an extensive housing program constituted at the core of an ambitious modernization program in post-war Sweden under social democratic rule, culminating in the so-called Miljonprogrammet, the building initiative that provided 1 million new homes over 10 years. It could maybe sound not so much with 1 million homes or 100,000 a year was suggested, but we have to remember here that Sweden is quite a small country in terms of population. At the time, we were around 8 million. And it's actually between 1965 and 1974, a quarter of Sweden's present housing stock was built as part of that program. So today we still, I mean, this is a real reality of Sweden in some way. We still live in this housing that were created in a very short time span of 10 years. Building activity since the early 1960s had been exceptionally high. And the period 1960 to 1975 are also referred to as the record years, rekordåren. Throughout the period, housing stood for a large component of total investment in building projects in Sweden. Around 30 to 40% of all building led to the construction of new homes. The process was industrialized and serialized with a significant proportion of housing constructed through large-scale projects, creating 100,000 units or more. This project saw the application of technology at a scale that hasn't seen before, large cranes, design production processes, and a close link between building technology research and its application in new projects. The developers for these projects were primarily, but not solely, local municipalities. Private developers were also encouraged to act. Financing came through a system of beneficial state loans made to individual developers and projects, municipalities or private companies, and very, very often a combination of both together. The structure of the loan system benefited large projects of over 1,000 units using the same building system, encouraging the rationalization and industrialization of the building industry and affecting the structure and size of the building companies that executed the work. And this is really crucial, because what's happening in this period is a total transformation of the building industry. And also here we have in some way to underline that this housing was not state-built. There has never existed a state-owned construction firm in Sweden. This was done by private building companies that during this period also merged into large, very large and even multinational companies. And the new prefab technology meant these major changes in the industries. And this had to do also with, one also had to ask, why a program? There was already high building activity. Why did we need a program? And part of the program was an idea in some way to steady the building, controlling the building industry, so we didn't build too many houses, and also to kind of keep the prices low. And here you can see how the building companies, and also was a shortage of workers. And here we can see how the building companies was very active in establishing this new technology, changing in some way the constructor worker into a factory worker. And this is a bit that really needs to be properly researched, and this is one of the areas I really want my hope is actually to get a PhD student to write in some way the cultural history of these kind of systems. Yes, you're welcome. Partly because it's also very interesting how the companies, like for example, we have a company acting there who called Olsson & Skåne, who are very on the forefront of developing this kind of really streamlined system of construction. Skåne is merging into Skånska Cement, that later become a very famous company called Skanska, that you probably have met if you have been working as an architect. A multinational company already at the time, in 1965, they already moved part of their production to Switzerland, for example. So we have here a kind of very interesting combination of state initiatives and the emergence of big international multinational companies. So comes out of this program. The creation of this state-initiated housing program was a kind of clear manifestation of a political ambition that has its roots in the economic crisis of the 1930s and Sweden's successful navigation of this crisis. The post-war years in Sweden saw an unprecedented increase in living standards and consumer confidence, and many of the political objectives and reforms in the 1930s looked possible to realize within a social democratic mixed economy. The provision of good housing to state sponsorship was central to this Nordic model of social democracy, an economic model that combined welfare initiatives with individual ownership and the idol of high consumption. In this model, the home was central tool for governance. The housing program was engineered and designed through the application of academic research on the family and its spatial needs. You can see an example here. If one reads the underline, she's cooking a fish gratin and with a fruit soup after. And here's a study of how much she moves in the room. But also, if you look at the cupboards behind, this is carefully checked out, how many coffee cups you need, glasses, and so on. Everything kind of coordinated into a kind of very well researched, and also a lot of full size tests of this new homes. Minimum recommendations were established and codified in a series of publications by Bostadsstyrelsen, the governmental agency for housing. God Bostad, Good Housing, was first published in 1954 and in 1960 and 1964 and was central to the whole program. And that covered in detail both spatial and programmatic design from playgrounds or even urbanism to laundries, kitchen, all the way down to the storage and execution volume and disposition of cupboard space. So all the way down to how many socks you had to the overall urban planning. And it's actually a very interesting thesis now based in Stockholm at KTH by Eric Sigge, who looks on the kind of institutional history of this governmental agency. These parameters were also built into the procurement system that enabled the Million Programme. State loans were given on the condition that the projects in question fulfilled the recommendations, turning them in that sense into standards. You were given the loans if you met up to these standards that were set in these books. So thus, at the level of scale, organisation, and detailed design, the state steered the environment produced via criteria attached to the provision of funding. Now it's very exciting to see if this works. This ambition of the Million Programmes was all the time actually very lot of interest internationally. And I found a very little sweet, very fun film that I want to show you, which is actually produced by NDR and BBC in combination. I tried to find a German version, but I have here snippets out of the English. Now we'll see if it works.
The concept of the satellite town was pioneered by the Swedes after World War II. They are detached commuter suburbs with their own services, but unlike English new towns, still dependent on the mother town for jobs. Since the war, Sweden has led all other countries in the number of new dwellings built per 1,000 of the population. 2/3 of them are flats. And the building trade in Sweden is highly industrialized. In fact, the government is increasingly making standardization of building methods a condition for acquiring a government housing loan. This is to try and rationalize the labor force and speed up the pace of housing production. School and shops are concentrated in the middle of the development. Swedish planning follows strict norms. For schools, 1,000 square meters of area for each 1,000 inhabitants, 10,000 square meters of playing fields and open space, not more than 25 children to a class. Footpaths lead off to the flats. Nobody is more than a 10-minute walk away from the shops and the school. The courtyards are well equipped with children's playgrounds, never more than 50 yards away from their door. Wooden benches and tables for sitting out are provided for adults. And there are arcaded walkways at the bottom of the buildings, very necessary during the long winter snows. Each floor has its own animal sign for easy recognition, and the lift buttons are at child height. A four-room flat with fully equipped kitchen, dining area, bathroom, and balcony. Rent, about £60 a month. Rent subsidies are worked out on income and number of children. For instance, a couple earning £2,500 a year with two children would only pay a little under £10 a month. So, in theory at least, most people can afford to live in new, modern flats, and segregation by income is avoided in Swedish developments. All the flats have access to a wide range of communal services in the basement. Also in the basement, the laundry rooms. Each housewife is entitled to 4 hours a week of washing machine time. And each housewife has to do her share of tidying up, or people will know by the missing key who is to blame. The Swedes seem remarkably geared to communal living, and there is very little antisocial behavior at Helbo at any rate. The laundry facilities also include spacious drying rooms, ironing rooms, and even carpet cleaning. And all these services are included in the rent, as is the use of the underground car park, 1.2 of parking space per family. The fact that it's being paid for encourages people to use it rather than leave the car out in the street.
Yes, this film was made in the 1970s. And already in that time, the program is starting to be heavily criticized. It also runs into problems. One of the issues was that as part of steering the building industry and a pressure from the building industry, one had long contracts for executing houses. The housing shortage was totally acute in some way in the early post-war years, were already in the mid-1965 already covered, and there was no need for this housing. And the new housing coming up got harder and harder to fill. When Olof Palme, the then prime minister and leader of the Social Democrats, threw himself out in the foam, in the play foam, in this fantastic project called The Model, a model for a qualitative society. It was a playground, experimental playground, done by children on the Modern Museum by the artist Palle Nielsen and the network called Aktion Samtal, Action for Talk or something like that. Who was a group that already very hard had started to criticize the whole kind of million program. So in this very same room where Palme threw himself happily out is the room where Aktion Samtal met and started discussing and criticizing in some way the whole basis for the million program. A couple of months earlier, actually in May, one of the most ambitious satellite cities, Skärholmen, had been inaugurated. This was a suburb based in some way around infrastructure and also based around a very, very strong orientation towards car. It was actually organized around a big, big, big parking space with the idea that families should have much more than 1.2 cars a family, 2.5, I think they were thinking. And this was also situated in the south of Sweden in the kind of node of shopping. It's also arranged around a big shopping center. This was inaugurated and got very happy reviews, except for the culture critic Lars Olus Franzén, that the next day wrote in the culture section of Stockholm's newspaper Dagens Nyheter, just tear it down. This polemic entry, where he continued saying there's nothing to do out here except shopping, started a kind of debate who's come to name Skärholmsdebatten. That was a general critique of Swedish 10-year housing policy. The welfare state's home building and the new satellite town became the symbol of a technocratic top-down society in which the citizens had been reduced to a passive consumer in a community development process based on an endless supply of material resources. In the wake of the record year, the role of housing in the welfare state distribution policies was widely questioned at the first time. The modernization process has acquired a kind of downside, described in debate in terms of squandered resources, ruthlessness, dreariness, and social isolation. And the Francien's argument, in some way, was also must be seen in relationship to what was going on inside the cities, the historical cities, that also went through a massive reconfiguration relating to the building of these new satellite towns. It was a certain tiredness of the project who never seemed to kind of be concluded. Growing up in Stockholm in the 1970s meant that you endlessly walked around kind of big building sites or mainly tear down houses. And it seemed sort and in some way fueled by the economic crisis that developed in Europe between 1973 and 1974. The welfare state ambitious housing program with its idol of high living standard, its emphasis on car-bound traffic, was suddenly at odds with the new environmental consciousness and the rhetoric of scarcity articulated by an active green movement. And in the Swedish context, the question that arose from the oil crisis was linked to a critique of consumer society and the consumer-based policies of the welfare state. This is quite often seen. There is a movement that is also seen as a kind of break and a kind of loss of confidence in the whole modernization project, and that is kind of quite often circulated around the event that is called the Elm Fight, Almbråket. This was in some way, a peculiar event that started at the same time as more or less the whole city was torn down, the whole kind of Renaissance inner core was torn down. It started a kind of very big discussions around a group of six trees in the middle of Kungsträdgården. But behind the debate was a kind of discussion about the planning process and the non-transparency of how things were decided. There was a group called Alternativ Stad who had kind of tried to check how were the decision taken, because the whole idea here was that was a position of a subway station, and why could that subway station not be placed in another place and so on, and they argue in some way for participation in the planning process. The event got kind of violent, and and all over the world was actually cabled out images of the Swedish police attacking kind of peaceful demonstrations, and that was quite a shocking at the time. And the day after this was happening in the nighttime, the whole area of Kungsgården was assembling people, and here we could see it across the political spectrum, from the right to the left. Age groups, also pensioners to young people, joined in this event and expressed in some way their kind of distress and negativity to the modernization process at large. And here again, it's quite important research to do. To look in some way at the different countercultures groups that in some way formulated a very strong critique of the Miljonprogrammet. That I've been writing a little bit about, a magazine called Alternativ Stad, who was produced in this kind of collective way around the protest organization also. And they also put up an issue that was in this time also become very central in the debate, and that was the role of the architect. The critique here, as we say, come very much to see the whole welfare state production of housing as is framed by a kind of consumer critique, and it's a discussion where the role of the architect has been in there. And here is quite a funny little. It's in the center of the paper, and here they asked the architect to be, instead of being a pin-up girl, he's an invikningspojke, fooled-away architect. And you're instructed, as you see up in the corner, to take the architect and fool him away. Because the architect has, in some way, with a close cooperation that is identified between the building industry, has just kind of fooled us. making beautiful drawings, telling how beautiful this kind of project should be, how good it should be, but we are all fooled. That's the kind of argument of this. And that led in some way to this debate also, that this drawing is probably drawn by an architect, by the way, led in some way that also architects left from, in some way, the engagement in housing. There was a professional guilt in some way. And so the whole kind of idea about a civic architect who was built up very much around the 1930s, the architect who is there to help society, to provide good housing, was in some way at this time, a long time, in total crisis. And the architect in some way, in many senses, redrawn. There was also, of course, a relationship to how in the kind of industrialization process, the role of the architect. And it was true that the architect in some way lost its influences in many senses when the building industry in some way took over. For example, when the building industry got in and got the possibility instead of, for example, drawing flats for every project, one had a standard set of flat layouts that could just be taken over and over again. And we see also towards the end of the Miljonprogrammet, it gets more and more repetitious in some way, and less and less adjusted to the local situation. But evidently, the architects were also very, very strong in the Miljonprogrammet, and they were involved in most of the projects. And we can also see, if you look at them now, they are very well executed and planned. So hard as this may be to understand today, the first in the more or less continuous series of condemnatory statement that have been made about the Miljonprogrammet was constituted in terms of its manifestation, not of idols of socialism, but of the mechanism of the market economy. And in the rear mirror, following the deregulation of the housing construction in the 1980s, this early criticism of the Miljonprogrammet can be seen as a first sign how housing as a policy object would move into the coming decades from being an instrument of economic redistribution to being a symbol of lifestyle and identity. And I want to here also show a series of very beautiful, I think, documentation of a housing estate outside Göteborg, Hammarkullen. And this is also an example of this kind of redrawing from architecture that happened within the profession. This is Jens G. Jensen, who was educated as an architect, but decided he couldn't be an architect after the Million Programme. He couldn't be participating in creating these horror environments, these dreadful environments without any soul and so on. And he turns instead into a photographer, and he decides in some way to map the social reality of the people living in this, as he says, dread environments. And he moves out to Hammarkullen and make a documentation of the life in this place. And he will also, interestingly, return. He mapped in some way the life there. And these images would also become, in some way, circulating in the kind of critique of the welfare state program. But also they are very, if you look at them, also very tender in some way. And it's also interesting, he produced a book, and then he returned 8 years later, and then again 20 years later, and actually again 40 years later. I should also say, he has just passed away, so I also want to show this just as a kind of contribution to him in some way, of this kind of very careful done documentation. And what he found out very much was that Hammarkullen was very much a transition zone. It was a place where you lived when you had nowhere else to live, as a period. As soon as you could, you moved out. And specifically, and maybe that was the main problem of the Million Programme, that was in some way constructed for the core family. Here sits a perfect kind of core family of two kids. That was what was planned for, never three. And they also left in some way. They, as the kind of housing standard already had gone up so much in the period, the standard in this very high standard houses in some way were not enough. And it was a real flow out of this into, in some way, bungalows or low-rise row houses. That also quite often, together in this housing area, more or less always, there is also a row house area attached to them. And also we can see after 1970 so on, the state starts subsidizing building of bungalows and small houses also through also loan system. He also in some way found out that the people who really enjoyed and loved these places was the older generation, the generation that had experienced the kind of dread housing situation in around Sweden, because the situation of housing was really, really bad in the 1950s, and they were very pleased with the modernization, while the next generation in some way were the ones who were displeased. So also, I should say, I maybe mentioned that before, that when the houses were ready, they were very hard to rent out. And there was a problem of overproduction. The really thing that actually the program was set up to stop was anyway happening because of the kind of long contracts. And that also meant that these were, quite often of these were in downhill spiral because they were standing empty. But with the kind of increasing immigration to Sweden in the 1970s, these were kind of filled of those people because here was available housing. And in some way, they started to form the real kind of core of an identity of these places very much, the first generation being Finnish immigrants. So in the liberal market economy of the 21st century, miljonprogrammet has come to symbolize the remains of everything that did not thrive through consumerism. Indeed, it has come to be identified with the specter of scarcity that the 1970s represent. And as a whole, the million program has become the symbol of the shortcomings of the welfare state planning and of modern mass housing. So a pressing issue today is how this extensive heritage from the Scandinavian welfare state is considered. I mean, between now and to the 2030, the condition of almost all these buildings that's made up the million program will be reassessed, and very many of them will undergo significant change or already have gone through significant change. It's been a series of quite actually nearly crazy project of changing the identity of this by huge building, rebuilding, retaking them down, recolor them, re-render them, and so on. It's been very much focused on changing the identity of them and changing the architecture. But now, in some way, the ones left are standing with very much issues around the technical system, typical with a 50 years lifespan, require a replacement. Equally, there is a strong need to update their energy performance to meet new standards. And today, the kind of major issue when you go in and restore this is, in some way, the risk of increased rents. It's also always a scare when people come in to restore them. And there's a big work now trying to find out different kind of systems of doing renovations that are not so costly. But as I mentioned from the beginning, they are also very present. I mean, as I said, a quarter of all housing in Sweden constitutes the million program. But the question in some way is how these buildings, so closely connected to the political product of post-war social democracy, are restored and reassessed in the current deregulated market economy. How do we understand processes of canonization, heritage and ideology in relation to recent past that already at this time of realization was devaluated aesthetically, architecturally and socially? And today the million program and the settler towns themselves represent a kind of anachronistic and disjointed urban planning idol. It's, I think, just because of that, it's crucial to have informed analysis of the real potential of these suburban estates. What qualities do these heroic structures possess? Can large scale and repetition and shared space become a strong rhetorical concept in the debate of city development? Can we in some way rediscover the advantages of urban dispersal? is it in some way the time for the revenge of the satellite town? And this is, of course, already, I mean, it's very clearly that these areas are starting to be canonized and also heritificized, or whatever you can call it, becoming heritage in different ways. They're moving in. And we can see, of course, the problem here of gentrification or other things coming in. But here, I think, in a way, this is a very, very strong demand in some way from history in some way, to write the history of these buildings, to both a kind of naive, ordinary architectural history, but also, as I pointed out before, their material history, and also, of course, a more kind of critical history maybe in understanding how this in some way were realized and the relationship between politics and housing. Okay, I finished there.
Thank you, Tordis. This was really intriguing regarding the whole idea of the welfare state. The past 2 days, I think during the conference, or at least the first day, on Friday, was, as far as I remember it, was very intense, somehow marked or characterized also by a certain nostalgia of the good old times of the welfare state. And I wonder also about what you described. This, apparently there was quite a strong critique quite soon in the early 70s or late 60s already. Probably and really a critique also of the consumerist approach within these welfare projects. Today, maybe from a similar cultural group, maybe more on the left, would argue there's nostalgia towards these projects. So it seems as if the perception of these housing systems goes in kind of circles, or there is something really strange how also the politics of perception change.
I think as I try to kind of point out in some way, it's interesting to understand that this first critique and in some way was very much a consumer critique. And later the same areas are criticized for not being consumer rich, so to say, not consuming enough. Yeah. So it's they get kind of attacked from both directions, and the architecture in both cases are seen as the cause. And I think that's also very interesting, that the architecture in some way is here always to blame. So and regards to nostalgia and things, yes, it's especially in Sweden, we love the welfare state now, and we dream back to this, of course. In the total deregulation, in some way, that this is the dream. And I must say also myself in that also the interest in this project is, of course, to, I think it's, as I say, very crucial to reassess them. But I know by doing that, I'm also, of course, part of that nostalgia and also canonization and so on that goes on. I mean, a research project like this is part of that. And then one can also then question the role in some way of heritage in this. What is the function in some way? And I, myself, I mean, in relation to my work that I've been doing about the monument, I perceive this in some way, the whole program as a monument. I've been really speculating if I even should kind of nominate it to the UNESCO World Heritage or something like that. The whole kind of process of getting this together and creating this much housing in such a short time span, I think is an amazing achievement. And it's also constitute today, of course, an enormous resource. And there we also see kind of quite scary things going on now. For example, quite recently, I mean, we have these are also seen as a burden very much for the municipalities. But now, for example, in one of the suburbs of Stockholm, risk capitalists has bought up the half of the housing estates because they see them as super good investments. And here the market kind of move in. And there was a lot of campaigns before that, you know, don't buy my Albi. and so on. But actually, after it's bought, it's quite scary to see. He's kind of just done a lot of good things, and people love him. You know, they have like this, you know, people who take care of their housing estate. So, but here we see, and that's happening quite a lot, in the selling out in some way of the public that is going on in Sweden very much. They are bought up and are seen as good investment.
Yeah. I think the very title of, of your talk, Restoring the Welfare State, shows that ambiguity, I think, between different positions. Yeah. I'm sure there are a lot of questions. Reinhold already announced one here.
Thank you, Tordis, for the introducing us to the tip of what is obviously a very large iceberg. And so in that spirit, you know, and also to try to connect the dots around here, part one of my question is just very simple. Can you say a bit more, tell us a bit more about the larger research project and what some of the other, your other colleagues are working on, to kind of give us a map of some kind of how the welfare state, as in, I believe it's the Scandinavian welfare state, basically, that you're looking at, or the Nordic, is being studied. The second part is if you could say more or inform us more about who lives, who has lived, and who currently lives in these buildings. And at which point and in what ways the demographics began to change as the population has changed, and ethno-racial conflicts in particular have, as I understand it, begun to characterize and shape the conversation. You know, to add that dimension to the otherwise, you know, as it were, more economic, political economic assessment of the program.
If I start in the end there, I mean, I very consciously has not talked about that in some way, because it's gone on an awful lot of research in that, and it has also been seen as the, in some way, the crucial issue, in some way, of this being multinational, you know, places in many sense, and also seen as the kind of problematic in that sense. And I think actually it's, and this is, I'm not really clear with this, but I think I want to take a position where I actually take the life and death of the houses and write the history from the, you know, the buildings themselves in different ways. And that's why I'm specifically interested also to seeing doing this research into the kind of construction process and so on, because that has not been done very much, while the other focus has been very strong. And in one way, they are there. You know, I think that's the kind of, they are there as kind of possibilities, this, regardless of who lives in them in some way. Of course, a lot of the renovation projects is dealing with and has to deal with how you, for example, go in and change these areas. And we saw in the 90s specifically, also again with state-run money, how a lot of money was poured into these areas with the idea of changing very much the identity of them. While in some way what is needed is larger flats or better kind of, you know, water system. And, you know, it's the technical that is needed in some way. That's in some ways more crucial, I think, than changing the identity of them, because they also start requiring quite strong identities. And the larger project, as I said, we are a kind of quite a big group of researchers that are. I mean, it's really in the starting up thing, but we have the Danish group, for example, of working very much with the landscapes around. Looking at the landscapes around the welfare state programs. Because one thing that's happening very much now is also with the kind of very strong idol of urbanization, they should be, you know, one more or less always the idea is that one should kind of build more houses in them and make them more dense. One has seen these kind of landscapes around them as too kind of large and so on. And there, of course, is a huge quality. I mean, that's the kind of whole point in some way in living in those houses, that you have the kind of free view and the big landscapes around them. So, again, it's also there to identify kind of existing qualities. So that is quite interesting project. It's by Ellen Brahe at the Oslo University, actually, landscape. And so there we have one. And then we have... As you may be more familiar with, Helena Mattsson's work around deregulation, that is very important also here, looking in that area. And as I mentioned, Erik Sigge also working with the whole kind of institutional history in some way of the different projects. My own PhD students, Mons, and Guttorm, who is kind of formulating his thing around the crisis and the idea about housing and crisis, and Mons around the whole idea about ideology, the housing ideology, who is also actually pushed much later. My own work has been mainly around the reception of the welfare state. So we and there, what I said before, I'm really lacking this kind of technical material research in it, and that's what I in my project would like to put an emphasis on.
So, Philip,
Have you also looked at education, architectural and planning education, that made this enormous project possible? Mm-hmm. And because it seems like every single architect first had to, or architects probably had to be trained for this program first, yeah. And what happened to them? And in West Berlin and in a similar way, the resistance or the critique against this program also came from within education. Was it the same in Sweden?
Yes, very much the same. And here, of course, I think I myself actually is one of the last who went through that kind of education. It was kind of cut in the middle in some way. Yes, I mean, from being a kind of architecture education in Sweden was very small. It was a kind of group of 20 architects educated on the Polytechnic every year. And it turns in this year into 60 students and then in two new schools, so up to 120 architects a year. So it's a massive increase of the amount of architects that are educated, and very much educated around producing this housing. That was the kind of main task in some way. I still know all the cupboard sizes by heart, you know. So I can do, you know, I knew exactly how the kitchen should be planned according to that. That's what we kind of learned, you know, as a... and then, of course, the total, when this, in some way, project and the economic crisis collapsed, a kind of unbelievably big unemployment by architects and a kind of crisis of the architects in the next period. And returning again, you know, the whole kind of critique of the civic architect in this, and then later a return of the architect as artist, as kind of creator, as kind of inventor in some way.
Thanks a lot for this lecture, and I really liked your slip when you said housing and crising. It's a crisis, production of crisis. You just think it's something that can be taken up. But I was wondering, how do you see these current art in the, exhibitions happening in the art context, like Tensta Museum and in the Tensta Kunsthal? Because if the kind of the critique also was initiated within the artist context, is it also that this kind of a push for reappraisal has been kind of really happening and also really not really happening at the center and Schaap Schoolman, but actually really from Tensta, which is one of these emblematic satellites? Cities, and also in connection to this, the work of Erik Stenberg there with the renovation and stuff.
So yes, I mean it's more or less nearly exists a category of million program art nowadays, and of course in all these regeneration projects, artists has been very much involved. And if I take from the critical point of view, one can say it's nearly industry of being part of this participatory project and design and so on. On the other hand, it's also been very, very productive in some points. And so there one can see, I think it's partly what Nicholas was talking about, a form of nostalgia, but also urgent need, as they are now really in the process of changing. And I had thought from the beginning actually to show a project that is done by Sprid Architects, who is exactly that type of project, who has worked very carefully with the process, but also involving artists in that process of discussing the project. So, yes. Yeah. And Erik Stenberg, he's also part of this network, and his work has been amazing in that sense, by also focusing very much on the construction system. And he had run this studio where actually the students has gone in and studied individual houses. And his thing has been very much to identify differences in the systems. They are very slight differences, but yes, that has been his kind of goal to identify in some way that they are quite much more different than one thinks.
If I may add something, since Tensta was mentioned, which is a large project within the Million Project, I guess, outside of Stockholm, since I know it a little bit, I think it goes back to Reinhold's first question, like, well, the users, have they changed? Or because I was just reminded of the film you were showing, the Scandinavian core family, and Tensta today looks very different.
Yeah, yeah,
I'm not
absolutely
sure whether you would find such a family.
No.
So I think there's also something that has changed within society and the users or inhabitants and the subjects of, well, they're not really treated as subjects, but the inhabitants of these large housing projects.
Absolutely, and that, again, to go back to this thing of this more or less naive kind of study of the construction system. For example, it's a lot of this Million Program is kind of organized so by having load-bearing walls that you can change the interior very easy. And that is, of course, part of that kind of identifying what is the need of the people living there. And one very, especially in Tensta, actually, because Tensta has a very repetitious or very quite small flats, is a need for bigger flats. And it's not that difficult to do that. But actually, a little bit more difficult in Tensta because they have another construction system than in, for example, in Alby, where they have done the houses in a way that are much easier. So that is also in some way to identify what you can do within this by knowing their material history. And it's also crucial there that, I mean, I've been working quite a lot on in the archive of the Architecture Museum. There is nothing in the archive from this. I mean, this is a quarter of all Swedish houses. There is nothing there. There's no collection of drawings. There is no knowledge about it. And I think that's, in that naive sense, it needs to be coming up in some way to also understand how you should act with these houses in their different renovation projects. So it has a quite, in some way, quite banal and practical understanding of the material and going all the way, in some way, over to the maybe more kind of complex issue, how this program was realized.
Well, first of all, thank you very much. I think it's very important that this case is included, right, in our general overview of different housing or different solutions to housing question. And I have two questions. One is more out of my ignorance about Swedish evolution of professional discourse in the 1960s, 1970s. In the Soviet Union, as a result of in this vast mass construction campaign, already in the 1960s, there was this strong critique of similar type of neighborhoods, similar methods of construction, right? And as a result, there was quite some visionary production. So my first question is very factual. Is if some of those critiques produced actually some visionary alternatives, and maybe in some way they were reworking either typologies or these materials or methods, so in some way not completely rejecting this architecture, but offering some kind of alternatives. And the second question is a more general one, which is actually, I mean, I think it's a fascinating story that you tell us, but we are very cautious in the way how we frame this story. Basically, you told us that Sweden, thanks to the, a number of things, certain prosperity, particular a party in a combination of factors actually solved its housing crisis thanks to Million Program. Moreover, in the 80s, when the migrants arrived of different kinds, the housing stock available also helped to solve the second question that kind of links us to the discussion that yesterday Andrew raised. So maybe we shouldn't distinguish between refugees and
all the different players on the housing market, maybe they are the same. So actually, we are talking about some kind of success story, but we are all very cautious, and I would like maybe to hear your opinion. Why are we so cautious in discussing successes of these stories? Is it maybe embedded in this professional trauma or this professional guilt that you described? Thanks.
Yeah, to answer first your first part of the visionary, no, it's actually, I'm very familiar with that. Also, it doesn't exist at all. I think that's interesting. It's not that kind of. I think it's interesting that. I think one felt as an architect very part of the process, very strongly actually. And in some way, it's a harsh waking up in some way when it's realized and when it's not received. You know, it's and I think that has a lot to do with the kind of economic situation at the time. It's kind of nearly painful to look into the kind of presentations of this architecture projects, the catalogs presented of the most ideal housing, the fantastic. I mean, the belief in the projects are amazing, that they actually should do something. And that, in some, yes, that should be very nice to look in closer to that, why the reaction was so hard later, the shock in some way, like this Jens Jensen who goes out and is totally, he's angry, you know, he refused to be an architect because he's filled this kind of guilt. So no, the visionary and the, you know, the escape into the drawings and so on is, yeah, it does exist, but it's not kind of big, it's very little in some way, I should say. And then was the other thing was the, yes, we can talk about success story, but it's already at the time seen as a catastrophe. So I perceive it in some way as an amazing achievement. But I think success or not success, one can see, I mean.
There's another question here.
Hello. Thank you very much for your presentation. I just wanted to ask you if you have the data on transnational or international exchange of either knowledge transfer or technology transfer, because coming from Yugoslav background, I know that habitology studies of Swedes were very much welcomed in Yugoslav circumstances, basically post World War II, and especially during the 60s and 70s, during this boom of housing construction. And for example, I know that there was this donation of concrete factory, concrete elements factory to Austria from Sweden. So could you, do you have the data on these transfers that were very active in Europe, for example?
I know about it. For example, I mean, yes, absolutely. It's a lot of technical transfer, both in some way, on as I mentioned, that already in 67, something like that, the Skåne system that is invented in Sweden, is they have a construction process all around the world, more or less, in Malaysia, in Africa, in, you know, it's in that sense, and they set up factories.
East
in
Germany
as well. Yeah, in East Germany, yeah. So that, of course, is... and then also one should also remember maybe the influx of architects into Sweden. Igor Dargalin, for example, who built Tensta, who planned the whole Tensta, is from Greece. So, for example, we had a lot of architects coming from outside working in Sweden. So it's not like an isolated kind of you know, group of Swedish architects in some way. It's quite a lot of transfer in different directions. But I don't have exact dates and things like that. No, I haven't. But that specifically, as I said before, with the construction thing, I would love to map that more thoroughly.
In the recent publication by Mark Svenaton and Tom Avermaete, they frame the Swedish welfare state as the democratic type of welfare state, as giving equal access of universal to the whole of society. And Helena Mattsson, she challenges this concept and saying Swedish welfare state is a consumer, really a consumer risk welfare state that educates individuals via, you know, a good way of consuming in the right way. And did you reflect upon that with regards to housing, as housing being a consumer good, as to be and to educate the inhabitants to the consumption of them?
Yes, I think Helena's analysis is, we have had a lot of discussions about that, is very right, actually. And also, as I pointed out here, in some way, is the critique that comes is against that. I mean, that's where the critique emerges in some way, that is a consumer, the high consumption society that is created, where absolutely the home is a kind of center for that in some way. Already in the 1930s manifesto, Acceptera, that is a big issue, how you should handle consumption or not consumption. But they have a fantastic arguments about the right consumption and the wrong consumption, and the wrong differentiation and the right differentiation, and also very complex arguments around luxury, for example, where that should sit in the whole. So yes, I think that's it's a necessary in some way. Nuancing of the kind of common traditional understanding of the Swedish welfare state.
But how does that reflect in housing or in the way that housing was produced at that time? How would you
I mean, just in some way that the base idea that you should have a home is in some way a consumption, you know, that is a part of the consumption thing. The provision of housing, of good housing, is part of that. I should say that's simple in some way, that it should be a high standard of housing.
What's the current status? How much of this housing stock of Million Program is privatized? And how then this affects this kind of current situation about reappraisal of construction systems and everything? And also this idea of that these were a really specific industrially produced system for which you need to have kind of the similar type of industrially produced systemic elements. And then how this goes with the fact that a lot of these mass housing are also now individually privately owned as units.
How should I answer that question? I mean, they haven't, I mean, this part of have been sold, they have not yet been, it's not the Thatcher model, so to say, where they, I mean, they have discussed that very much and wanted to introduce that, and they have done it in some places, the possibility of buying out individual flats out of the, but otherwise that's not really the system so far. It's been rather that some parts have been transferred over to private landlords, still being rented flats. And then there exists also, of course, when they've been, and that has also seen as idle to in some way, sell this to the inhabitants, and they take care of it. And that has it has happened, but not that much in some way. I don't think it relates in some way to the construction system so much. That, I mean, this construction system was used in private housing and in public housing. I mean, it's used in all, you know, different type of. It's not that it's specifically for this type of housing, even if it's kind of executed more there. So, I mean, for the experiments, for example, with the first experiments with prefab housing were taking place in one of the most famous, one of the most exclusive suburbs of Stockholm, Djursholm, for example, is the high rise there. So it's not like they are specific to, in that sense.
A simple question, is it possible kind of to explain roughly the different steps between the 70s, the 80s, 90s, and the 2000s, and where we are now? So what happened in between? Just to understand, because if you talk about public housing and how it was kind of managed then and in between up to now in Berlin or in other places in Germany, there's kind of a cultural history, or also a political and economical history, which is quite complex. And just a remark in terms of Berlin, I think there was never a nostalgia, or there's no nostalgia in terms of public housing. Public housing was criticized in Berlin heavily, especially in West Berlin, and then there was the squatter movement, which was the most outspoken movement against that kind of urban design and housing system. But it was also that that critique was then incorporated into early neoliberal schemes, where then the really leftish kind of agenda to continue to produce public housing, affordable housing for everybody, was just not answered, but turned into something else. And so there were two fractions of architects, like the architects who decided to go with the squatters and other people to renovate the Wilhelminian housing stock, and the postmodern architects who decided to do no politics at all. So this was the case. And nowadays there's no nostalgia, but I think it's just as a matter of fact that we have a housing question which comes not from within architecture, but within from economic needs of the people. And so this is why we turn back as architects to those houses. But whatever, I don't want to make a lecture here. I really would like to understand what happened in those 50 years somehow, economically and politically, and why are you now also, sadly, I must say, also at that point where your housing stock seems to be sold off to international capitalism. How did that come?
I don't think I can give you the whole history, because that's another lecture. But, I mean, we have an extensive deregulation in Sweden that takes place from the 1980s. I mean, one can discuss if we still have a welfare state or not. I mean, that's the kind of debate that's going on. Do we have a welfare state, or are we after the welfare state? And that's also part of the, in some way, the rhetoric of the title, calling it restoring the welfare state. So, I mean, the systems looks very different, basically. One also maybe should underline that the Million Program was never a social housing. It was public housing. That was very directed to an idea about, in some way, housing for everyone. And rented houses has never been seen as anything. It hasn't been kind of seen as a problem that is rented housing. That's kind of, you know, that's not really the ownership of the houses has. It's always been combined in some way with condominiums and things like that, together with rented houses. So that's slightly bit different history from also from the other Scandinavian countries, actually.
Ariane.
I was interested by what you said, that you want to do more research in the construction system, if I understood it right. And I was curious about what aspects are you going to consider, and if when you mean, when you talk about construction system, you mean the more technical procedures, or if you're going to discuss the companies themselves, is their history, because usually what we see that we have just housing policy history in which it's not always easy to understand who is building that. Is it the state, is it private? You mentioned already some information on that. You mentioned also a change in the, if I understood it right, in the ownership of the companies when you had this huge program, and you mentioned that it was kind of towards a multinational company. So if you could expand it a little bit more, I'd be grateful.
No, what's interesting, I think, is the system, how it was put up to kind of, you know, state beneficial state loans towards the building industry, and that in some way meant that the building companies had to totally change. Because if you should be able to build 1,000 units in one go, you couldn't do that as the structure of building companies as it was before. You had to merge, or you didn't get the work, so to say. And there you can see really it's a very quick, total transformation of the structure of the building industry in this time. Within 10 years, the building industry looks totally different. Yeah, just the kind of sizes of the companies and how they were organized and how they move in one way from being, you know, specialized in windows, in the, you know, now they, you know, do the whole process, the whole kind of set. So it's all the kind of organization of the workforces, the planning of the process is totally changed, also very quickly. And I think that is you know, that's a history who needs to be kind of investigated further. In all directions, in some way.
One last question here.
Mm.
Perhaps I missed something in your lecture, but I want to ask, who were the agents of critique of this social housing? In Vienna it was, for instance, a middle-class newspaper, very strongly, says the paper wrote about a cement desert, and when you go out it was all green, but it was enough to, how about this, Witwen? Green widows and so. Also, who were the agents, and how is the relation between aesthetics and politics or economics? Also, was the aesthetic critique a support for to re-establish or establish neoliberalism? And were the inhabitants the ones who were critic, or was it the media? Also the architects sometimes, they want to do more. Also in Vienna there did exist alternatives of plans. So what was this, and how is now the relation of the aesthetics at the moment of architects and the crisis and the coming back interest on public, no? Also the word public and social was for two decades really negative, no? And which part is now discussed this, and has this a relation with aesthetics?
Yeah, it's a very good question. It's interesting if I look at it that the first critique comes very much from the very, very left. And that's a little bit disappointing, of course, but that's really what's happening. It's coming from the countercultures, from that's where the critique comes from very, very much. As I try to point out, it's a kind of consumer critique very much. And then there is a quiet critique in some way by what the program was built for, this kind of core families, that they don't take up the housing. They leave it. So it's a quiet, that's not an outspoken critique. It's just a kind of, you know, you leave it, basically. You don't take up the offer. So that is, in some way, maybe the critique was most hard for the architects to take, that it didn't become this kind of popular housing that they were planning for. And then it's interesting in some way why I try to see that it's changed, of course, as in other countries also, the whole kind of political scene is kind of changed around in these years with the emergence of the Green Party. And around this kind of Elm fight, for example, we had a kind of spectrum of people from conservative to kind of radicals joining force in the critique of in some way the modernization process. And that was slightly also quite interesting for this group Alternativ Stad. They were very stressed because they were doing this as an action against planning in some way. And they were very aiming towards the alternative. And they also are the starting of the green movement in some way. And then they were, to them, people were hanging up also Save Stockholm in this very conservative, Save the Old Stockholm. And they took down the banderoles. And then they said, we also want. So they had a kind of, even in there, in the kind of fight, it was this different positions who didn't kind of clear out in some way. So, but I think that the frame anyway, and the kind of identification of this program as a failure in some way comes from the left and takes up in different ways.
Okay, I'm sure the housing question is obvious, remains alive. Yeah. Thank you so much, Tordis. This was really,
thank you
really,
for so many questions.
Really incredibly good. Thank you. There's more time to discuss over drinks and food. Thank you all also for your questions.
Yeah, there were so many questions.